Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. When sexual assault and rape allegations against Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein started pouring in a couple of weeks ago, he was fired from his film company and a culture of silence was broken. But we've been here many times before. Bill O'Reilly, Roger Ailes, Bill Cosby, Donald Trump. But this time, an avalanche of Me Too stories sparked a national dialogue about sexual harassment, causing many powerful men to lose prominent jobs, including NPR's Vice President of News, Michael Oreskes, and the popular actor Kevin Spacey. This renewed discussion has us asking, what kind of systemic change will come from Me Too? How will it affect low-wage and immigrant workers, restaurant workers, janitors, farm workers, Walmart workers, and so many others have been telling their stories for years. We've done a lot of shows about documentaries that have come out about the Walmart class action that was filed many years ago. What will it take for these workers to be treated with dignity and respect at work? Today, we're joined by two guests. Shireen Alamzadeh is a Chicago-based attorney and co-founder of Healing to Action, a nonprofit whose mission is to build a worker-led movement to end gender-based violence. Shireen is co-founder of the Coalition Against Workplace Sexual Violence, an organization that addresses sexual violence against low-wage workers. And Shireen Alamzadeh joins us from the studios of WBEZ in Chicago. Hi, Shireen. Welcome to the show.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Hi, thank you for joining us. We're also joined by Emily Martin, General Counsel and Vice President for Workplace Justice at the National Women's Law Center. Emily oversees the center's advocacy, policy, and education efforts with a focus on the obstacles that confront women in low-wage jobs and women of color. Emily also provides in-house legal advice and representation to the center. And Emily Martin joins us on the line from Washington, D.C. Hi, Emily. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'd like to ask both of you what you think about what's happening right now. I mean, the allegations continue to pour in based on a number of reporters are saying that more prominent journalists might come down in the coming months. I mean, Shireen, this is kind of an incredible time. What do you think about all of this?
Well, I think it is very promising and heartening that people are coming forward. I agree with you that there is a question about, you know, what's going to happen next, especially when we're talking about people who are perhaps in jobs that are less high profile, that are doing work that we've known for years has very high rates of sexual violence. But I do think that this is really promising. I think it's creating some deterrence for people who think that they can, sexually harass without consequences. And it's opening up a conversation that is reaching people across industries that is really reflecting how entrenched this problem is and the fact that it really, you know, it depends on all of us to address it collectively.
Emily, what are your thoughts about this? It's really interesting to think about what happened when Anita Hill testified against the Clarence Thomas, against his confirmation for the Supreme Court. And a national dialogue happened back then, and now we're seeing so much momentum. Why do you think this time around it's picking up so much steam? Why now?
Well, we're really seeing the power of women's voices in this moment, as so many women are coming forward in the press and through social media sharing their stories. And I do think that's one of the things that's different about this moment as compared to 1991, where Anita Hill did spark a really important conversation about sexual harassment, and it did lead to more women bringing sexual harassment claims and charges. But today, it's even, I think, more exciting, in part because the power of the Internet is allowing a lot of women to come together virtually in talking about what happened to them and discovering that they're not alone in these experiences. And that is tremendously empowering, especially because, you know, harassers operate by making their victims feel isolated and alone, making them feel like maybe this is somehow their fault. And so what we're really seeing now is the power of women sharing their stories to really push back against the false narrative that so many folks have about harassment being victims' fault.
Right now, there's so much attention on politicians journalists, actors. And we really wanted to do a show about low-wage workers and immigrants because over the years, we've done a lot of shows about janitors, about farm workers, about that Walmart class action that was filed. How long has it been now, Emily? Time just...
Oh, that's... It's been a while.
Yeah, it's been a while. Time just flies. But what are your thoughts about how this prominent campaign will affect these workers, mostly women, who often do not have protections at work?
Well, I think one of the things that is important about this campaign is that, you know, so many powerful women have shared their stories, women who people feel like they know and have some connection to because they're celebrities. But what I hope is one of the effects of that, hearing Gwyneth Paltrow talk about how she felt she had no options and no choice, is really to increase people's ability to empathize and understand why, if you are a victim of harassment, it might be really difficult to fix that problem. I think that when you are thinking about a celebrity who is rich and famous with rich and famous parents and a rich and famous boyfriend who still feels completely powerless to address this problem because of the gross power imbalance between her and her harasser, that really helps people understand how it's even so much more difficult if you are a single mom and your paycheck is all that's standing between your family and homelessness, why it can be harder, even impossible, to feel able to come forward with a complaint of harassment, and why, therefore, it's all the more important to really take action at the front end to prevent harassment and to ensure that our workplace cultures really are built around an assumption that supervisors respect the people who work for them, that coworkers respect each other, and that's sort of baked into the culture.
And Shireen, it's especially difficult for immigrants to come forward, especially in this political climate.
Yes. There have been reports across the country of a decrease in reporting to police about sexual violence by immigrant communities. There's actually a report, a survey done of advocates across the country that work with immigrant survivors that found that 43% of advocates reported having a client who dropped a case because they were fearful to move forward, a case against their abuser. And so we're seeing a lot of fear in the community, and very rational fear. I mean, there have been stories of people getting picked up at courthouses, in domestic violence cases. So I think that's another really big part of this.
Let's talk about specific industries. Shireen, you wrote a piece for Chicago Business, and you write that the Restaurant Opportunities Center 2014 nationwide study of more than 1,200 restaurant workers found that 78% of women surveyed reported unwanted sexual advances by customers. 78%. And then, of course, there's sexual advances by peers or bosses. And I want to play a clip. This is Maggie Guerrero, who was on Democracy Now! In February. Maggie is a shift leader at Carl's Jr. in Los Angeles, where she makes minimum wage and has no benefits, and she's part of the fight for 15.
Well, when I was working at Carl's Jr. in less than a year, I was sexually harassed. I had a coworker approach me and tell me that he wanted to have sexual relations with me, and I asked my manager not to schedule me with him anymore and to do something about it, and she said she would talk to him. But even after that, she still managed to schedule me with him two more times. So I brought it up to HR, and they just brushed it off, saying that I came up to them too late. And then on top of that, they promised me a raise for my shift leader pay that I never received. They just keep passing it back and forth to general manager, to the district manager, saying, ask them. And then I didn't want to quit because I needed to pay for my college education, and I was staying because I needed that. Like, right now, I had to drop out of school because I don't have enough to pay for my college.
Well, and in terms
that is Maggie Guerrero, who was on Democracy Now! In February. She's a shift leader at Carl's Jr. in Los Angeles, where she makes minimum wage and has no benefits. And Shireen, a new report came out from Heart Research Associates. An Eater wrote about it, and it found that women working in the fast food industry say that 40% experience sexual harassment at work. And like Maggie, many feel trapped in their jobs because, you know, they have to pay for college. They have to pay for rent. I mean, it's not easy for so many people to leave a bad situation.
Yes, and I think that these statistics, these studies, are really important to consider in this larger conversation around sexual violence in the workplace, because I think something that we need to focus on is the fact that this is an income inequality issue, that statistically, if you look at people in the lowest income bracket in our country, there are 6 times more likely to experience sexual violence in their lifetime than people that earn higher incomes. So when you hear stories like this about how a person is staying in an abusive environment because they need to pay rent or because they need to save money for college, it really draws attention to the lack of the social safety net that we have for people who are working in poverty, living in poverty in our country. And we need to see those issues as sexual violence issues. I think about how swift and urgent the response has been to, for example, some of these reports of sexual harassment in state capitals, that legislators want to prevent this from happening in their own workplaces. And it reminds me of the fact that there have been all of these bills for a $15 minimum wage, for strengthened protections for low-wage workers, for, you know, social safety, you know, a social safety net, like helping people pay for college or providing housing assistance. And legislators aren't as swift to advocate for these policies. But I think it's really important to look at gender-based violence through an economic justice lens. Mm. And I'm really happy that some of these worker rights organizations are trying to really shine a light on the really traumatic and violent outcomes that happen when we don't actually lift people up out of poverty in our economy.
Emily, what are your thoughts on that, specifically when we're talking about restaurant workers? Another study from Restaurant Opportunities Center United deemed sexual harassment in the restaurant industry is endemic. A study found that 90% of employees, men and women, reported having experienced sexual harassment on the job. And they specifically asked people at chains like Applebee's and Denny's, those kinds of restaurants, what kind of protections do these workers have without unions?
Well, that's a great question. One thing that I will flag, I hardly agree with everything Shireen said. And in particular, when we're talking about restaurant workers, one of the reasons restaurant workers are so at risk of harassment is precisely because in many states, they are only entitled to a cash minimum wage of $2.13 an hour, and that hasn't budged in decades. So what that means is that if you are a server, that most of your paycheck depends on whether your customers like you or not. That creates a very difficult situation if you are being harassed by customers when really your entire livelihood is in their hands. And it creates a whole culture of objectification that infects the restaurant industry. And you're right, in the absence of worker organizing, whether unions or through other sorts of workers' rights centers, it is really difficult for an individual to stand up and say, this is wrong, I'm asserting my rights here, because, you know, people have realistic fears about retaliation. And retaliation for complaining about sexual harassment is illegal. It's clearly against the law, but that doesn't mean it doesn't happen. So it definitely makes things harder when you don't have a union or some other community of coworkers to turn to, since it's difficult to fight these fights on your own.
Emily Martin is General Counsel and Vice President for Workplace Justice at the National Women's Law Center. Shireen Alamzadeh is a Chicago-based attorney and co-founder of Healing to Action, a nonprofit whose mission is to build a worker-led movement to end gender-based violence. Today, we are talking about the Me Too campaign, which has just really exploded when sexual assault and rape allegations against the Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein started pouring in a couple of weeks ago. He was fired from his film company, and then so many women decided to speak out. A lot of actresses, actors, politicians are speaking out. There's a lot of stories about what's happening in Sacramento. And then we also have a number of journalists speaking out. NPR's VP of News, Michael Oreskes, lost his job. The popular actor Kevin Spacey lost his job. But we decided that we wanted to focus today on low-wage workers and immigrant workers. We've done a lot of shows over the years about restaurant workers, janitors, farm workers, Walmart workers. What will it take for them to see change and for them to be treated with dignity and respect at work? You can join us at 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. Have you experienced sexual harassment or assault in the workplace? Did you have the protections in place to feel like you could come forward without losing your job? What changes do you want to see? And if you work in a low-wage field, what is your workplace like? 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. or tweet us at Your Call Radio. Shireen, when we're talking specifically about low-wage workers, and unfortunately because there's been such a decimation of unions over the years, very few workers have protections. Given that, what kinds of changes could we see? We're going to talk about janitors in just a couple of minutes. There was a very powerful documentary, Rape on the Night Shift, and a number of janitors in California came forward and talked about being raped and sexually harassed while they were cleaning buildings at night. And Governor Jerry Brown in September signed legislation that establishes workplace protections against sexual violence and harassment for custodial staff. The SEIU got behind this. But what do you think about these kinds of efforts, and what would you like to see?
I think these are great. So the Yabasta Coalition, I think, is what you're referring to in California, which is bringing together people from different sectors and movements to really fight for the rights of janitors. And it's really a great example of worker-led organizing. I know that in addition to the legislative work that they're doing in California, they're also doing a lot of work around peer leadership and peer education. So helping to train workers to be that support system that's often missing for survivors, particularly in marginalized communities. That's similar to what we're doing in Chicago. So Healing to Action is working to build a leadership program that can bring workers together across industries. A lot of what we've seen that's been really powerful has been organizing within particular industries, particularly industries that do have a union presence. So, you know, you have the SEIU in California, here in Chicago, Unite Here. Local One is a hospitality union that organized to pass an ordinance that protected hotel workers from guest harassment, so strengthened existing protections. And those are really great examples of workers in particular industries trying to add to existing protections and fill in some of the gaps and really address some of the problems that are unique to their industry. So with the janitorial workers, one of the big issues that they were focused on was the issue that so many of these workers are working in isolation, you know, working the night shift where there's really nobody else around. And so trying to figure out ways to protect them from that particular vulnerability. Here in Chicago with the hotel workers, the issue was that there wasn't an adequate protection against guest harassment. So there were clear legal protections for people who were being harassed by supervisors or coworkers, but when it was somebody who was just coming in and out of a hotel, it was unclear what the responsibilities of a hotel were in those situations. So this bill was really trying to clarify that. And with Healing to Action, what we're trying to do is build on some of these efforts to try to bring together workers across industries, particularly industries that are not as well organized, that perhaps don't have the same labor organizing protections, and really show the power of bringing survivors together to share their experiences and to try to support one another in building a network so that when more people come forward, there is that system of support. There are people that can talk to you about their experience, that can help you navigate the legal system, that can help you talk to your family or loved ones if you're feeling ashamed or traumatized and to do so. So we see a lot of strength in also trying to work across industries. And we actually had a symposium a couple years ago where we brought workers together across the city to talk about this issue in different workplaces. And it was people from different ethnic groups, different racial backgrounds, different languages. And what we saw was the power there was of really seeing that the people weren't alone, that this wasn't just because they were in this particular bad job or working with this particularly bad supervisor. It wasn't just because they were undocumented or because they were African American, that this is an issue that really spans industries and that it's important to build these multiracial, multi-industry alliances to try to address the issue.
Well, like I said, the Center for Investigative Reporting and PBS Frontline teamed up on this Rape on the Night Shift documentary, and I hope you can all watch this because everybody needs to see this. According to the piece that went along with the documentary by Bernice Young, Under Cover of Darkness, Female Janitors Face Rape and Assault, according to the U.S. DOJ, 50 people a day are sexually assaulted or raped while they're on the clock. 50 people. And for janitors, it's really bad because a lot of women are working in these tall buildings at night. And after that documentary aired in September, a number of janitors went on a hunger strike here in California, calling on Governor Brown to sign that piece of legislation that establishes protections against violence and harassment for custodial staff. And he did sign it right after a hunger strike. And in this clip, you're going to hear Jasmine Castillo. She's a janitor. You'll also hear Alejandra Vales. She is with the SEIU United Servers Workers West.
He immediately came in my face, you know, and touched all my breasts, you know, and basically grabbed my breasts, you know, and say, "Oh, nice logo and you teacher." I immediately, you know, pushing him. I remember, you know, I'm pushing him and I say, "I put a charge on you. This is not fine."
Castillo reported him, but the union that represents the women says far too many others remain silent.
Many of them fear that because of their documentation status, that they may not see their families, that if they say something and the police are involved, that police might call DHS or immigration and that they're going to come get them instead of actually offering help.
Assembly Bill 19...
And that is a clip of Jasmine Castillo, a janitor who went on strike in September in California, and Alejandra Vales. She's with SEIU. What's interesting about this one, Emily, is that these janitors do have the protection of a union, and they're still afraid to come forward.
You know, one of the things about harassment on the job is that it's an exercise of power, and that means that if you are a worker in a low-wage job, you are at increased risk of harassment because you just have less power on the job given your status in the workplace. And I think that unions help a lot, but that fundamental dynamic is the dynamic that we're seeing that continues to put women at risk. One of the things we're doing at the National Women's Law Center to try to address these problems, we just launched an effort called the Legal Network for Gender Equity, which allows women experiencing harassment and other forms of discrimination to connect with attorneys who are willing to do a free legal consultation and who are willing to take cases in these areas, sometimes pro bono or reduced fee. Since so much can be changed by having somebody just talk with you about what your rights are, to give women some sense of what they can do, how does the law protect them. You know, it's very difficult to navigate on your own, so creating those links between people experiencing harassment and discrimination and attorneys who can give some advice and legal resources is another important step.
Emily Martin is General Counsel and Vice President for Workplace Justice at the National Women's Law Center, and Shireen Alamzadeh is a Chicago-based attorney and co-founder of Healing to Action. On today's Your Call, we are talking about the Me Too campaign and how it will affect, hopefully will affect, low-wage workers and immigrant workers Restaurant workers, janitors, farm workers, Walmart workers, they have been telling their stories for years. There have been documentaries and class action lawsuits. So what will it take for these workers to be treated with dignity and respect at work? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will be joined by Robin Laguerre Henderson. She has a new memoir out called Immigrant Girl, Radical Woman, a memoir from the early 20th century. It pays homage to her grandmother, Matilda Rabinowitz, who immigrated to the U.S. from Ukraine in the year 1900 at the age of 13. She was radicalized by her experiences in sweatshops, and she became one of the most revolutionary organizers of the 20th century, believing that women should feel entitled to equal rights, equal pay, and sexual and personal autonomy. Back then, and it's still happening to this day. We're talking about sexual harassment on the job and rape on the job. The Me Too campaign has really exploded. We are seeing so many powerful men lose their jobs, including Harvey Weinstein, Kevin Spacey, NPR's vice president of news, Michael Oreskes. And so a lot of people say this is the beginning. There's a lot more coming. We are talking today about how this will affect low-wage and immigrant workers. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Leave a comment on our Facebook page. Tweet us. Robert just left a comment on our page and said, I had a family member who was abused at a low-wage food job. She was very affected by it, and I think it eventually led her resigning her position. So those are the numbers that we don't have. How many people actually just leave the workplace because they can't handle it anymore, especially in low-wage jobs? Today we're speaking with Shireen Alamzadeh, Chicago-based attorney and co-founder of Healing to Action, a nonprofit whose mission is to build a worker-led movement to end gender-based violence. She's also co-founder of the Coalition Against Workplace Sexual Violence. And we're joined by Emily Martin, General Counsel and VP for Workplace Justice at the National Women's Law Center. Let's talk about farm workers now. In 2013, Frontline produced a documentary called Rape in the Fields, and we did a show about this. It tells the story of the price many migrant women pay for working in the fields and packing plants to stay employed and provide in their families. And this documentary specifically focused on the fields here in California. And in the film, Dolores Huerta, one of the founders of the United Farm Workers, says that female farm workers have been abused for generations. She says she became aware of it as a young woman. In fact, her mother would never let her work in the fields. Here's a clip from that documentary.
Harassment is part of the job, so to speak. Women are looked at as sex objects when they're out there in the field. Sexual harassment is an epidemic in the fields, and it again goes back to the vulnerability that women have, the farm worker women have. They work in isolated places. Many of them don't speak English. A lot of them don't even know the laws. They don't even know that they can report sexual harassment and that the employer can be responsible for that. And so they feel helpless.
And that is a clip from Rape in the Fields. This aired on PBS a couple of years ago. You can find it. It's available online, and a very good documentary. A lot of these women spoke out for the very first time. And now I would like to welcome Mariana Sofia Santiago to the show. Mariana is a certified Spanish and Portuguese interpreter in the medical and legal field, and she has worked in the fields in California's Central Valley with women who have shared stories about being raped. Hi, Mariana. Welcome to the show. Can you hear us?
Yeah.
Hi, are you there?
I can.
Okay, hi.
Yes, I'm here.
Welcome to the show. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I just quickly wanted to chime in and say that I worked for 16 years in the Central Coast in the Watsonville farm fields, helping as a what I would call myself in the conversation here a human link, a support and facilitator, of course, with language. Through the medical and legal, circuits, as people who are injured workers in the workers' compensation arena, many of them, especially in recent years, women started to feel more comfortable coming forward. And so my clients would be a woman who had been raped in the strawberry picking field of Watsonville, for example. And what I just wanted to say in corroboration, I think adding something that hasn't been said yet to these fine ladies on the air, is the fact that in terms of the hashtag #MeToo, or in Spanish, Yo También, is not only am I a professional providing nuanced and very sensitive, empathetic interpreting services, but also I am a rape victim. I was raped as a child. I was gang raped as an adult in San Francisco. And I understand the reticence of these women coming forward. An example I can give you is a woman I met at a physical therapy appointment, and we were both very early, and I had a chance to talk with her, and we were both in tears before we went in for physical therapy, because she divulged to me that she had actually been raped by a fellow Mexicano in the field, and that this happened to so many women. So I just want to say that the piece of many of us, you know, professionals who are being human links. You know, there's the links that you can say, you know, on the internet, but there's also human links. And I appreciate you reaching back to me, Rose, because I think it's very important to be optimistic that there's many of us trying to help each other, like literally on the ground, in the field. Mm. And this is very powerful work. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Sophia, for telling your story and for doing the very important work that you do. What do you think came out of this documentary, Rape in the Fields? Because, again, for the first time, so many women in California who are out there doing really tough work on a regular basis, I mean, not only do they have physical ailments because the work is so difficult, but now they've got to deal with sexual harassment and rape. And this got a lot of attention. In fact, just last year, there was an op-ed in the New York Times, Protect Female Farm Workers. What has changed as a result?
Well, one of the demystifying statements I clearly want to make here is that the assumption that everybody, I think, without any blame, it's just ignorance and just not knowing. When you talk about harassment in the workplace, you, at least I'll speak for myself, I tend to think of, oh, it's a white, dominant, powerful male. That can be in the farm field situation. So I'm going to answer your question, but I want to be clear that these situations of women now coming forward with greater comfort, and again, relating to the film that we're both talking about as well, it happens with their own national, you know, compadres, their own people. Mm-hmm. It's not a boss. It's their field worker right next to them. So what's happened with this example of recent years with women, you know, sharing the truth of their story is what's coming out from this film as well, is that women are feeling more supported. They're feeling more safe to tell the truth of working past the shame and touching into the anger that is underlying what they're having to go through. Even, I will say, in a physical therapy situation where I am standing there to interpret exactly what the physical therapist, you know, says to the client. So I just want to say that this is a very complicated and nuanced situation. I happen to have been raised, I'm a native speaker of Spanish, so I speak 6 dialects of Spanish. I'm very sensitive to many different countries, Salvadoreños and Mexicanos and Costarricenses and Colombianos and all of that. And that has served very well in this particular situation, on top of which, as a woman, I also completely identify because I've been through my own, you know, my own journey. Let's just put it that way.
Mm. And also, Sophia, since this film has come out, and I'm sure the women who were interviewed saw the film and it was shown to a number of farm workers, how has it changed the women?
How has it what?
How has it changed the women? Are they more...
I think I will be happy to restate it. I think that women, even farm working women, feel more empowered, and they feel more permission, and they feel supported, and they feel encouraged to step forward and to not hide in the shadows of shame and denial. I mean, a lot of this is also just within the culture of Latin America. I've lived in Central and South America and studied. I have a degree in Latin American studies, and I can tell you that it's very ingrained in the culture that women basically now no longer as much as past are feeling more empowered to step into truth and truth-telling. And I think films like the one that we're addressing about rape in the field is a really great conduit. And I think that's really the message I want to leave here, of optimism, that there is the human link, and there is the support, and there is this whole hashtag Me Too, Yo También is allowing the permission of somebody who is a farm worker, not just a movie star, mm-hmm. to come forward. And I think that's something we can all feel very optimistic about.
Yes, and that is why we wanted to do this show. And so I want to thank you for contacting me on social media, the power of social media sometimes.
It really works.
Yeah.
It really works. Ladies, it's been an honor to be with you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Sofia. That is Mariana Sofia Santiago. She is a certified Spanish and Portuguese interpreter, and she's worked with a number of women in the Central Valley who have been raped. Today we are talking about sexual assault, sexual violence, how this Me Too campaign will affect low-wage workers and immigrants. And really, it's great to hear Sofia say that farm workers especially feel empowered to tell their stories. We're joined by Emily Martin, General Counsel and Vice President for Workplace Justice at the National Women's Law Center. Shireen Alamzadeh is a Chicago-based attorney and co-founder of Healing to Action. They work to build worker-led movements to end gender-based violence. Shireen, what did you think about what Sofia said, specifically about farm worker women here in California who feel empowered to tell their stories?
Well, I was very grateful to Sofia for sharing her story and her leadership in her community. I think, a lot of what she said and also what you said, Rose, are really ring true. This is a industry that is really, really vulnerable. And there's a lot of different hazards in farm work and field work. So, you know, these jobs, when you think about a person who's working in the field, a lot of times they're doing back-breaking labor, very difficult labor. It's hot. There are environmental hazards. There are, you know, the job is very isolated. So just thinking about all the stressors that a person has before this type of violence occurs, and then recognizing the incredible prevalence. This is one of the industries in which sexual violence is the most prevalent. A couple of studies that have been done across the country have found that 8 in 10 women in the fields report sexual violence. It's been so ubiquitous, it's something that happens so often that there's even names that have been created for field work, like the Green Motel or the Field of Panties. So these are terms that have circulated around around farm work and the issue of sexual violence. But I also think that, you know, given the incredibly pervasive nature of the problem, that this is an area and industry of workers who have shown incredible innovation and resilience in what they've been doing. Farm work is really where the peer support model started, the Promotora model, and you see that model being used to have people in the field, health workers or other farm workers who are learning information and resources and sharing it with each other, recognizing how precarious the labor is and how a lot of the people working in the fields may not be in that area the whole year. They may not have documentation status. There's a lot of different factors that might make it that they wouldn't know what resources are available to them. So we see that. There's also a really inspiring project that was started by an advocate called Monica Ramirez, who started the Bandana Project through the Southern Poverty Law Center, where essentially they went across the country and had people reclaim the bandana, which many women reported had been used to cover their faces so people couldn't know their gender when they were working in the fields, as a way of sort of protecting themselves from being sexually violated. And so they took these bandanas across the country and they wrote their stories on them and they drew pictures and they had events that talked about the issue. So I think that this is so one of the sayings I like to use when we're talking about this issue is that the hottest fire can create the strongest steel. And I think that's really the case when you're talking about farm work, because it's this incredibly difficult work in this very high-risk scenario for sexual violence, but you see really creative, passionate advocacy, and, you know, you saw that with Sophia calling in, people who are just putting their all into trying to address this issue and support one another in their communities.
David Bacon, a labor organizer here in the Bay Area, wrote an op-ed in the New York Times called Protect Female Farm Workers last year. And he wrote that the average wage for a female farm worker is about $11,000 or $12,000 a year. And then he also wrote that the biggest impediment to fighting harassment in the fields is this country's immigration policy itself. Federal regulations forbid legal aid organizations like California Rural Legal Assistance from directly representing undocumented people, which makes it very difficult for people to come forward. And he says this is why we need a path toward documentation and legal employment, so these women can actually report the rape and the harassment. Can you talk about that, Shireen?
Yeah, so I think that, there's a lot of structural barriers, and I think Emily mentioned earlier that National Women's Law Center has a program that's trying to connect people to advocacy services, but the landscape, there's a lot of structural barriers to people coming forward that are really a matter of political will and the way that we want to try to limit, you know, people from accessing services, life-saving services, as a result of their immigration status. So this is something that really needs to change. I know a lot of legal aid providers in Chicago as well who are limited in what they can do for farm workers, for immigrant workers, as a result of these types of restrictions. And it's a huge problem that really needs to be addressed if we're going to try to pursue equal access for all, because, you know, essentially people know that certain people lack access to these resources and representation, and that makes them a target, and that really enables that problem to proliferate in some of these workplaces that are have a very large immigrant population.
Emily, what would you add to that, specifically talking about the laws and current law, what it prevents, and then what changes you would like to see?
So in terms of immigrant victims, current law doesn't do enough to ensure that legal aid is available. But also, even if you're lucky enough to have an attorney, I've represented undocumented victims of discrimination in litigation, and technically they have legal protections. But in those cases, the employer really knows that the plaintiff is vulnerable, that the individual coming forward is vulnerable because of immigration status. And employers use that in litigation to intimidate and harass all over again those women who are able to bring a complaint. So the law needs to provide stronger protections to ensure that regardless of your immigration status, you can enforce your rights in court and receive full remedies to avoid that really terrible incentive that employers now have to hire undocumented people precisely because it's so difficult for them to enforce their rights in this country, and thus so much easier for employers to coerce and exploit them. One of the reasons that I'm hopeful about the current Me Too moment is because we are hearing from, you know, powerful women and less powerful women. We're hearing from a whole range of voices that coming together, my hope is, will provide real political will to strengthen protections against harassment in a way that will help women in low-wage jobs as well as higher-wage women. So, for example, one of the issues that's received more attention in recent weeks is the fact that in most states, if you are an independent contractor, you don't have any protection against harassment and discrimination. And that topic has arisen because of the entertainment industry, where those relationships are common, but it certainly is not exclusive to the entertainment industry. Lots of folks in lower wage jobs, whether they're cleaners or Uber drivers or some other contingent work, are technically independent contractors instead of employees. So That's an example of attention to an issue where there is a need for stronger legal protections, which I think has the potential to really help folks in low-wage jobs as well as the more privileged voices that we're hearing from in these stories in the media.
Yeah, let's hope, because unfortunately so many people are now contractors with very few, if any, protections. Let's hear from a couple of callers. We've got just a few minutes left. Let's go to Margie in San Francisco. Hi, Margie. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thank you so much. It's a terrific show. I was thinking about the fact that field workers are invisible to food shoppers and that custodial work is invisible to the daytime occupiers of businesses or buildings, and that if there were very strong evidence, a lot of people who work in buildings, that there had been any kind of assault or harassment, you could still protect the person who had experienced the harassment. But if people knew what was going on and it was reported not simply to the contractor to pressure the contractor, but reported to the businesses that are inside the buildings that are being cleaned, that would help a lot.
Well, thank you. I remember Rape on the Night Shift did mention specific companies because they contract out a lot of this janitorial work. And it might be interesting to bring on some of the people who worked on these documentaries to find out what changes have happened. So thank you for that call. We have a comment from on our Facebook page from Robert. It says, I was a fast food restaurant manager and learned the hard way that I was abusing an employee. I was very oppressive to her, and I didn't find out until after she quit her job. This was in the 1970s. My supervisor told me about it. Sadly, I never had a chance to apologize. So I think men need to change this stuff and admit their own failures without being completely condemned. I do think people normalize behaviors within themselves. None of this will change unless men change. I didn't sexually attack her in any way, but I think it was more about job duties. Shireen, what are your thoughts about that?
I think it's an important realization, important observation. You know, a lot of focus when there is a harassment story that comes out of an employer is protecting the reputation of the employer, having a swift response. But there isn't really much focus on prevention and what can be done to change a workplace culture. So, you know, I think that it's important for employers to really look inside of their companies and think about what might be some issues. Are there huge disparities between genders in terms of management and, you know, and people who work for management? You know, are there equal opportunities for mobility for women in the companies as compared to men? Is there pay discrimination? Are they paying men and women different wages? All of these things lead to power imbalances, which enable gender violence to occur, and then making sure that you're creating a culture that is really valuing people for their work and is not imposing gendered expectations on them, that you're not discriminating against people, whether it's subtly or in a way that's actually actionable, about having family responsibilities or being pregnant. These are all issues that tie into the issue of sexual violence, and a lot of times employers wait until there's a crisis to try to address that individual and then try to kind of isolate what's happening in their workplace is attributable to that one bad apple that they didn't know about. But there's so much work that can be done. And I think to tie this a little bit to the caller before, you know, consumers have a role to play here too. People who are using these office buildings, who are purchasing food, you know, there have been some really interesting and innovative ways of connecting consumers to the business's workplace standards, whether it's how restaurant workers are treated at their favorite restaurants or, you know, how the food that they're buying is you know, produced up the food chain and how workers are treated along the food chain. So I think those kinds of efforts are really important because they create accountability for employers beyond just responding to specific allegations of unlawful behavior, but actually working to shift the culture and also in a lot of ways with larger employers, shift the industry, shift industry standards so that people have very different expectations of what the workplace should look like.
And sorry, Sanchez, we don't have time to take your call, but Emily, similar question. What can the general public do to help? Sanchez said that he worked on an ordinance to help protect hotel workers, but it got rejected.
So the general public can definitely talk to lawmakers about the needs to provide strong protections with a particular focus on the needs of of people in low-wage jobs. That's definitely important. It is also important to be a consumer who cares about these issues and to speak up, to talk to the brands that you purchase from when they are in the news for discrimination or harassment, to make clear this makes a difference in the consumer choices I make, and I need to see your leadership on these issues. And then another thing that's important for people to do is to speak up as bystanders, you know, in their own lives if they see harassment or discrimination in their jobs. One of the things which is important is not just teaching victims how do you make a complaint, how do you come forward, not just training people so that they understand better what is and isn't harassment and can behave accordingly, but making sure that people who see inappropriate behavior in their personal lives say, hey, that's not appropriate, that's not cool, that's not acceptable here. That is also really important for changing the culture.
Emily Martin is General Counsel and Vice President for Workplace Justice at the National Women's Law Center, and Shireen Alamzadeh is a Chicago-based attorney and co-founder of Healing to Action. Emily and Shireen, thank you both for the work you do, and thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Coming up tomorrow, we'll speak with Robin Laguerre Henderson about her new memoir, Immigrant Girl, Radical Women. It pays homage to her grandmother, Matilda Rabinowitz, who immigrated to the U.S. from Ukraine in the year 1900 at the age of 13. She was radicalized by her experience in sweatshops, and she became one of the most revolutionary organizers of the 20th century. She believed women should feel entitled to independence, equal rights, equal pay, and sexual and personal autonomy. I hope you can join us for that. Your Call is produced here at KALW in San Francisco. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. You can also find us on iTunes, where you can give us a review. Follow us on Twitter at Your Call Radio. Email show ideas and feedback to yourcall@kalw.org. Thanks to Laura Flynn for producing today's show. Lauren Schechter is our social media producer. Carolyn Beltzem is our intern. Kevin Vance is our studio engineer. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.